Testament lesson comes to us in the 24th chapter of the book of Deuteronomy. You recall that as we made our way through the commandments, the first Sunday of the month has always been the commandment itself. The second Sunday is then the echo of the commandment and the legislation in Deuteronomy. And so what we've been doing over the course of the year is drilling into the book of the covenant. So that's chapters 6 to 26 of Deuteronomy. The reason we've been doing this is because in the same way that kind of Romans is the book of the New Testament, and this is the typical Roman Catholic complaint whenever Protestants say the Bible, they mean the New Testament, whenever they say the New Testament, they mean Paul, whenever they say Paul, they mean Romans. Everybody wants to know about Romans. Well, in the Old Testament, that book is Deuteronomy. It's the book the prophets lean on and rely on. It is the book that really is the summary of the Pentateuch, and it's the book from which the Old Testament provides the perspective from which the Old Testament history is written. Right? So having a good understanding of the Book of the Covenant means to have a good understanding of the history in the Old Testament, to have a good understanding of where the prophets are coming from. And whenever there's an appeal to wisdom, the wisdom literature, you'll know the law then at the basis of the foundation of those claims. And so one of the insights of the last 150 years of, since the beginning of kind of the archaeological explosion of the ancient Near East is ancient covenantal forms. And so it has altered our understanding of the outline of Deuteronomy, and so what you see then in Deuteronomy are these echoes of each of the commandments. This is why we've been looking at it. And so today, verses 8 to 16 are the echoes of the ninth commandment in the Deuteronomic legislation. It'll sound miscellaneous, right? But I'll get into that in the sermon as to why it all appears. So from Deuteronomy chapter 24, beginning at the in cases of leprous disease, be very careful to do exactly as the priests who are Levites instructed. You must follow carefully what I have commanded them. Remember what the Lord your God did to Miriam along the way after you came out of Egypt. When you make a loan of any kind to your neighbor, do not go into his house to get what he is offering as a pledge. Stay outside and let the man to whom you are making the loan bring the pledge out to you. If the man is poor, do not go to sleep with his pledge in your possession. Return his cloak to him by sunset, so that he may sleep in it, that he will thank you, and it will be regarded as a righteous act in the sight of the Lord your God. Do not take advantage of a hired man who is poor and needy, whether he is a brother Israelite or an alien living in one of your towns. Pay him his wages each day before sunset, because he is poor and is counting on it. Otherwise, he may cry to the Lord against you, and you will be guilty of sin. Fathers shall not be put to death for their children, nor children put to death for their fathers. Each is to die for his own sin. This is the word of the Lord.
Thanks be to God.
Let us pray. May the words of my mouth and the meditations of all our hearts be acceptable in your sight, our rock and our redeemer. Yeah, before I begin, I want to thank you. You all were very kind to me after my sermon last week. I very much appreciated that. First Church was less kind, and I kind of want to say this about that. I was met at the door, and someone put it to me that I couldn't be both against lying and abortion at the same time, and so they were very disappointed that I had decided to be against lying. Which is by way of saying, the sixth commandment, thou shalt not kill, is the sixth commandment, and the ninth commandment, thou shalt not bear false witness, is the ninth commandment. And what I say, it's not just my professional opinions to say that those are commandments, and I'm for them.
truth
is often different from something we wish it would be. Having teenagers, I'm figuring this out. Those of you who've had teenagers know this. Anyone who deals with small children. Truth sometimes hurts. And the truth will set you free. This morning from Deuteronomy 24, we're covering the entirety of the legislation that surrounds the Ninth Commandment. You shall not bear false witness against your neighbor. At first glance, this may seem odd, particularly with this passage, because what appears before us are four apparently disparate, miscellaneous sets of laws. The first is a rehearsal of leprosy statutes and the pointer of Miriam, Moses' sister. The second is about collateral and loans. Thirdly, Moses addresses paying wage earners. And finally, we're reminded that each one will be judged and punished for their own sin. What links all these together, though, is the Ninth Commandment, and in this way. Each of these laws has to do with prohibiting false or vain speech. As in giving and taking an Israelite's word as his bond. The commandment particularly forbids false and vain speech, especially when it's spoken to the detriment of others. Now, why is that important? We're used to picking and choosing what we hear and what we believe to be true, with the exception of the kind of science that you can verify in kitchen physics experiments. We have to take their word for it that neutrons are made of quarks. You'll never discover that in your kitchen. For example, have you ever tried to help someone and they just won't take it or hear you? Once, in Michigan, as a college student, I was commanded by my grandmother to help one of her friends, an old woman indeed. I was to drive her into town, she couldn't see very well, and help her return something to the hardware store. Seems simple. I drive my friend into town to the hardware store. It's not a big town, there are only two hardware stores. She showed me the receipt, I read the receipt, and we drove to the True Value hardware store. In the lot, she became enraged that I had taken her to the wrong hardware store. No, this is the hardware store on the receipt. It is not. You are acting very strangely towards me, right? This is the height of insult. So I agreed. And I drove her back all the way across town to the Ace hardware store. In a huff, she got out and marched into the store, furious with me. A few minutes later, she was back in the car, upset that I had allowed her to embarrass herself. And so we drove back across town to the True Value store where she completed her return. There was, you see, only one hardware store that would accept a return. The others would not. It's not that small a town that you could return something in the one hardware store and they'd work it out at the delivery. Yeah. Truth is what it is, and not necessarily what we want it to be. Moreover, this is extremely important for a biblical world. Truth, despite what you may have recently heard, is discernible, meaning that truth is discoverable, meaning that my grandmother's friend's receipt was not lying to her. Words, in very large part, make up the world in which we live, much of the truth as we understand it. Bears repeating that we get married speaking words. We name children speaking words. We raise children speaking words. We enter into schools by putting words on a page. A collection of words becomes a resume, becomes a career. In each of these things, a marriage, childhood, career, is as robust or as fragile as the words we use. For you remember that marriages and careers end with the speaking of words. This commandment forces us to be very careful about the words we use, particularly when we find ourselves tempted to injure our neighbor with our words. More than that, our words are a form of love in the community. We speak the truth, and in speaking the truth, we are able to live in grace and in truth. It is important to know, for example, whether there really is a fire in the theater, that I am who I say that I am, and that we can be trusted to know the difference between the truth and the lie. Moreover, that I and that we as Christians can be counted on to stand up for truth, even to stand up for our neighbor's good name when we need to. This is a difficult commandment precisely because it requires us to relinquish our tribal loyalties and instead cling to the Father whom the whole family of heaven and earth is named. This commandment is hard because it forces us to think about how we use our speech, how frequently we use it to hide an untruth, how frequently we use our words to harm and injure others, often intentionally. Take another example. From time to time, our physicians will give us a prescription for medication, and the medication comes to us with instructions. Is the medicine taken once, twice, or three times a day? Do we take one tablet or two? Should we take the medication with food or should we not? This is where truth is, right? They aren't lying to you, the pharmacist and physician. Things go horribly and tragically wrong when either the instructions are wrong or we can't be bothered taking the medication as directed. Imagine approaching your medication the same way you approach things in boxes with instructions. I'll just take it till I feel better, dear. It will be fine. Now, this is what's behind the leprosy laws in verses 8 and 9. Verse 8, we're reminded that in the case of leprous disease, the Israelites were to follow the priest's instructions precisely. This was for the protection of the community and the good of the afflicted. Commandments were too important to be ignored when something of such magnitude was involved. And here Moses is reminding us that we ought not lie to our priests, no, it's nowhere else on the body. Nor could we safely go about ignoring them. The people needed to be honest with their priests, and they needed to follow their instructions, because what they were providing was the will and way of God. Verse 9, the Lord adds the example of Miriam. Now, the story referred to here is found in the first half of Numbers 12, and it's of Aaron and Miriam who have had enough of Moses, which is to say everybody has enough of their preacher, even when they're your brother. Moses and Miriam, Aaron and Miriam have had enough. They've had enough of his sermons, enough of his leadership, and enough of endlessly following him around the desert. And so they start to spread the rumor that they, too, are the Lord's mediators, and that they too are to be as honored and obeyed as Moses, and when it comes to a vote, it's two against one, do what Aaron and Miriam say. And what they're doing is speaking falsely about Moses and his relationship with the Lord. They're also mistaken in the role that Moses is playing as mediator of God's people. And so the Lord summons the three siblings to the tent of meeting. Moses knows what is coming, and he's immediately on his knees attempting to intercede for his brother and sister. But Miriam and Aaron, in the cloud of presence, are punished. And Miriam is made instantly leprous. sent from the camp, and eventually, after suffering the shame of her rebellion, she is healed after following the priest's instruction. It is an example of how seriously the Lord takes the truth and the seriousness of the consequences for vain and false speech. Verses 10 to 13 are about pledges made as collateral for a loan. Although interest was forbidden in Israel, they could offer a loan on security, and it's something of similar value. Unable to repay the loan, the debtor would be asked to present the collateral. The important point was that it was the debtor who presented the collateral. There could, you see, be no forced repossession in Israel. You had given your word to present security, and your word was trusted when you were asked to present your security. As the maker of the loan, you just couldn't barge in and seize what you thought was worth your time. Rather, you took the word of an Israelite that this, whatever the security was, made good on the debt. The last thing that could be offered as a pledge or as a collateral was a cloak, a garment that functioned as a coat by day and a duvet or a comforter by night. The practice among the pious was for the creditor to keep the cloak by day and return the cloak at night. One trusted the debtor not to abscond with the cloak. One trusted the word of the debtor that he would make good on the loan. In returning the cloak every night, the debtor would bless the creditor, and gratitude would be shown to God for his will and his law. If a hard-hearted creditor refused to hear the truth, or worse, refused to live obediently to God's command, then the debtor would cry out from his persecution, and the Lord would hear him, and in the end, deliver him and punish the creditor. Being poor does not make one untrustworthy. And that's important, particularly in our age. Being poor doesn't make you untrustworthy. Likewise, the ability to manipulate words in our age, to use a word processor in a legal office, does not make it acceptable to oppress anyone. Verses 14 and 15 are again about being as good as your word. When you offer paid work, you must pay for the work. The same kinds of conditions apply today. We all do this. When you contract with a service company, you pay as the contract specifies. Fair enough. But when you contract work that day from a day laborer, you pay that day at the end of the day. We violate the commandment when we string folks along with the promise of payment. This is especially egregious when our promises lead children to go hungry, while we gorge ourselves on processed food-like products. Likewise, your word is your bond no matter who you give it to. Promise a laborer a wage, you must pay regardless of where he is from or how oppressible you view him to be. Our age, you see, tends to vilify difference. In fact, one of the signs of the declining influence of the church and falling church attendance in the United States is precisely the increasing vilification of difference. Believe it or not, Christians are the ones in this country most able to be in a room with many races in it and not be offended by that. The shorthand in our age is identity politics. Part of what the Ninth Commandment means is that truth is truth, no matter who speaks it, and no matter to whom it is spoken. We can test truth, certainly. But the final test for truth is not our preferences. The final test for truth is conformity to the word and the decree of God. And that's experimentally verifiable in your kitchen. Drop a tennis ball and a baseball at the same time, they'll hit the floor at the same time. They can conforms to the decree of God. Finally, in verse 16, Moses reminds us that the foundation of Israelite law is accountability to and responsibility for living in the truth. Living in the truth is the very foundation of the law of God. Mendacity, that's the fancy word for lying. Mendacity affects all areas of life. There is a reason, for example, that the scout law begins with trustworthy. Or to put it in the way Jesus does, the devil is the father of lies. What this passage is showing us is that we can lie to others, we can lie to God, we can even lie to ourselves. But something in us shatters every time that we do. The point, though, is that we can go to the Lord Jesus Christ, who knows our feeble frame. There's no need to lie to Christ, because he knows us as we really are, and he loves us. In turning to Christ, and in being honest about who we are and what we are, we will finally be able to live with the truth about our own lives. And the truth is simply this, that we are sinners of Christ's own redeeming. Indwelling us by his Holy Spirit, Jesus Christ transforms our lives and enables us to live in the truth. For it is only as those who have given their lives to Christ that we are able to affirm fully and finally that our yes is yes, and our no is no.